Today at Reader's Corner, Alan Minskoff, author of The Idaho Traveler. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The Idaho Traveler explores the often ignored treasures of small-town Idaho, from historic buildings and sites to the mom-and-pop restaurants that offer the best pie and breakfast in the Gem State. Interviews with longtime residents and newcomers alike illustrate this paean to Idaho and capture the essence of what defines Idaho's unique character. Alan Minskoff moved to Idaho in 1972. He lives in Boise and teaches journalism at the College of Idaho. He's the author of Idaho Wine Country, a book Alan and I chatted about on a previous Reader's Corner interview. He is a prolific poet, writer, editor, with contributions to magazines, journals, and books too numerous to mention. Alan and his wife, Roanne, are major contributors to the arts in the Treasure Valley, Wood River Valley, and Idaho, both through their leadership and generous contributions. Alan joins us today in the studio to talk about his latest book, The Idaho Traveler. Alan Minskoff, welcome to Reader's Corner.
I'm delighted to be here.
So, Alan, tell me, for starters here, how this fits in with the previous journey you took across Idaho when you were a newbie to Idaho, I believe, or almost anyway. Tell us how that fits into what you're doing this time around.
Well, in the 70s, I was kind of an accidental journalist and even more accidental magazine editor. I was here, and in short order, there was a big battle over old buildings in downtown Boise, and I joined that, and a bunch of us started a magazine called Idaho Heritage. And we're sitting in our office one day, and we look around the room and say, we are called Idaho Heritage, but we don't know a thing about the state. And we were a not-for-profit in all senses of the word. And so we wrote a grant and got it as part of the bicentennial. And we traveled the first year, 1976, to 15 towns around the state, all under 1,000 in population. And the next year we went to another nine. So 24 towns in all, and over 2 years, two magazines. So here I am 4 decades later thinking, what are those small towns like? What's changed? What's the same? What are the issues? How could I kind of recapture that moment in a book?
Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a trip around the state and have you comment on some of these small towns. You've talked to some great Idahoans living in these towns and who are keeping them going, and I want to get there. But let's talk at the 30,000-foot level for now. You mentioned, you know, what remains the same, what's changed. You have an article at the close of your book that was actually written back in the day when you did it the first time. And you have some quotes in there that might be a good place to start. Growth concerns people. No, in 1976, growth concerned people. Well, I can only imagine that that hasn't gone away in your most recent travels.
In many of the towns, growth is a real issue.
Mm-hmm. And one that I thought was particularly relevant, frankly, a little surprised to see it back in 1976. I had no idea in 1976 what was going on in the state of Idaho. Limited immigration to the state was strongly endorsed, was the quote, I think. So is that the same kind of immigration issue that we have today, or were they just talking about somebody coming in from Iowa?
I think it was different back then. I think there was less tension back then about California. Californians coming to Idaho.
Right.
But there, you know, there was a real conversation. These town meetings were like little cauldrons where you got to hear all kinds of opinions. Sometimes they were, you know, loggers versus hippies. And sometimes they were people who simply didn't want the towns to change. Others wanted economic growth. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of some threads that carried through the 4 decades. Mm-hmm. Economic growth, housing, things that you might expect still are manifest in these small towns in Idaho.
Which is exactly what you heard on the latest trip.
I heard a lot of similar things,
yeah.
A few things that are different. Housing really is an interesting issue in a town like St. Mary's up north, a beautiful town with a big payroll there, I think, two timber operations in town and one not far. So there's a payroll and the people are prosperous, but there's no housing.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue that we heard in St. Mary's that I also heard in Preston and other places is motels don't want to come there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, both those towns, Preston and St. Mary's, have good fishing and good hunting right around them, and so they would love to have a place for people to stay, but they really don't.
Mm-hmm.
And the motels can't make it pencil out, evidently.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Preston for a moment. I think one of your quotes regarding Preston is that it seemed like a robust town. I forget the word that
prosperous,
you – prosperous yeah. town.
It
and you, you cited the fact that it had two car dealerships. I thought, by golly, I never thought about evaluating a town as prosperous, but you don't usually see two car dealerships in
Not
a
in
little
small
town.
Towns. The other thing is they've invested $10 million in their hospital. Now, that is a lot of money. It's a lot of money anywhere.
Yeah.
But for a town of that size, $10 million investment in their hospital is remarkable.
For those listening who may not know where Preston is, you may maybe you can explain
yeah,
just
Preston's
how far it
takes.
It's
in the southeast corner of the state and, yeah. in fact, educated this massive bestseller by Tara Westover. She lived right outside of Preston. Mm-hmm. Her little town was, I don't know, within half an hour of Preston.
And it has one other very famous thing going on. That would be the movie.
Right. Of course, Napoleon Dynamite was filmed there.
Right.
And they still take people to the Napoleon Dynamite house, although it's pretty modest and not it's not much of a tourist attraction. But the high school was used there, and it was the setting for that fun picture.
Yeah. And I think you also mentioned that the Great Bear Massacre.
Yeah, right that, outside of Preston, right which was a horrific massacre.
Yeah,
and they are going to do a monument to it, actually a place where you can visit
yeah.
and an interpretive center.
I mean, there were hundreds of Native Americans slain by army, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a slaughter.
Yeah.
And I think it is responsible for those people who want to remind us mm-hmm. that our history with Native Americans in Idaho and other parts of the West is pretty tragic.
Yes, exactly. You also said back in the day when you were writing the first rendition of what small towns in Idaho look like that they're not immune from alcoholism, child neglect, education of the young, and isolation of the old. Have any of those changed dramatically?
Well, my coming back sometimes was quite brief.
Yeah.
And I tried to focus on individuals who could tell their stories.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any doubt that those issues still are manifest, not only in small town Idaho,
yeah.
but throughout Idaho,
yeah.
and maybe worse in some cases.
Yeah.
I don't think there was any meth when I went there in the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. It may be a different kind of drug than it was, whatever it was back then. Probably marijuana back then.
Probably.
Yeah,
for sure.
So, pie. You seem to have a particular fascination with pie in this book. And I think at one point you actually say that you're on a statewide quest to find the best pie.
Well, we call the sections the Idaho Pie Trail.
Yeah.
And let me just add that I wanted to do – I'm a little bit of a food writer, and as you know, I wrote a book about
right.
wine. And so I wanted to have a little bit of something that if people weren't interested in this quest to go back to small towns. So we wrote about Big Idaho Breakfast and Idaho Pies for a couple of reasons, and there was some structure to it. We only went to places that were mom and pops that were not part of a chain. We would go to a place like the Orchard House in Sunny Slope. And the Orchard House is owned by a couple of ladies down there. And they are so serious about pie, they will only serve you a slice. You can't go there to buy pies. Now, there are others around the state. I remember a wonderful place in Bonner's Ferry, Mennonite Place. The Mennonites are great pie makers. I had no idea. So pie became a way to kind of slip into places, get a feeling for the culture, gain 10 pounds over 16 months, and eat some really good pie.
Well, as a matter of fact, now that you've done that, I wonder, are you able to name the best pie you've had anywhere in the state, or might that inhibit your book sales?
Well, I don't know if it will or not, but I will give you, as any good cautious journalist / politician talking about his book, I'll give you three examples of
okay.
places from around the state. Up north, there's a pie place, the Pie Safe in Deary, Idaho.
Oh, Deary,
and it's
right.
extraordinary. It is also run by the Mennonites. They have incredible weavings up there. They have a cheese place adjoining the pie place. They have breakfast. They make their own ice cream. It's a remarkable place. So that in Deary, I was recommended by friends of mine from the University of Idaho, and it was a great recommendation. Close in, I would say the Orchard House that I just mentioned in Sunny Slope, the pear pie there is at the top of my list. In eastern Idaho, the Wayside Inn, which was a sort of accidental. I was hungry one night, and I went there like at 8 or 9, maybe 10 o'clock, and I did traditionally – I ate the liver and onions just to see if it was good. It was excellent. And then I had a peach pie with vanilla ice cream on the side. And it was remarkable. And a story went with it. It turned out the waitress's daughter was tired of waiting tables. And the baker left. So she spent 72 hours really almost nonstop trying to memorize their – they had good instructions – their pies. And that was one of the better pies I ate in the state.
That's great. You're listening to Alan Minskoff. He's the author of The Idaho Traveler. Before we get off the subject of food, I must say, and you alluded to it, you do fill up the reader. I mean, even though I'm just reading this stuff, I'm full listening to you describe yourself coming out of these restaurants. And the one that really got me, because I know I've been out to dinner with you a few times, and I know that at least in my presence, you ate a little bit more sparingly than you seem to have eaten on this trip. And notice, you went into some place in Notice and you had a 6-egg omelet. That's a pretty good size omelet.
Well, we won't do for our work.
That's right.
So the Garage Cafe, again, I am a person who really believes in restoring old buildings. The Garage Cafe was a great use for an old garage. And they pride themselves not only on big breakfast, but on enormous burgers. So I went there with a family who are friends of mine, and I said, okay, who's going to try the 6-egg omelet? So the dad and I both went for it, and I think if you know you're going, it's probably a good night to have a salad dinner so you're just sort of famished the next day. So I kind of tried to plan that because Big Idaho breakfast, like the Garage Cafe and the 6 eggs, it's a lot. Although I have to be honest, by the time I was in, say, the 14th or 15th month of this, I would like not eat everything on my plate.
I'll bet.
I have to admit it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Elk River. And we're hopping all over the state now. So Elk River is like east of Moscow, Idaho. Is that right?
Sort of east of Moscow and east of Lewiston, if you would do a little triangle.
Right.
And it's, I don't know, maybe a 45-minute to an hour drive. It depends because the last 17 miles are some of the most they're windy and there are lots of logging trucks.
Yeah.
And if you think you can hurry there, you're making a mistake. Yeah. And you shouldn't because it's a beautiful drive too.
I wonder if you could talk about Elk River in the context of Idaho as a resource economy, once upon a time, heavily dependent on timber and not so much anymore. And this isn't the only town that you visited where you found this, but if you could just describe how things have changed.
Honest, we have lost a lot of our logging operations. A lot of the mills are gone, from McCall to Elk River to other places throughout the state. Elk River was a mill town when we went there in 1976. And when we went there, if you don't mind, I'll give you a little context. It was one of the most fun meetings we had. We had 90 people. I think there were 150 or 200 who lived there. So when I mentioned that this time, one of the old timers said to me, well, you're not a lot to do here. So everybody came to our meeting. Well, this time it was more sort of accidental than almost any place I went to. I was in their place where you ate. It's also their lodge, and it's the meeting place for people in town. And we just talked to people as they came in. Now, one of the city council members came, and they did go and get a guy who's been there 60 years. But Elk River is tiny. It's in the trees. It's beautiful. It's maybe around an hour from the Moscow campus, and the kids come there to have a good time. There's no sheriff. it's great hunting and fishing, and I didn't get to eat there, but I think people say the huckleberry pie is really good there.
I see.
But well, how do they live? Here's a huge generational shift. Back in the day, the mills were closed, the timber was closed. Now sometimes they're dependent on where the Forest Service says you can cut timber. So some of them have to travel 45 minutes or an hour to find the timber that they used to be able to kind of walk down the lane to find.
Right.
There are a lot of people who were in Elk River for a long time and very proud of it. And they recognize that it's tiny and it struggles. For example, they talked about the winter. They can get 6 to 9 feet of snow. And they don't have the resources that we say have in Boise where the plows are going to come out. They got to have to take care of this themselves. So they have some of the same issues. Health, you've got to go an hour to get to the hospital. So it takes a certain type of rugged individualist, really, to live in a place like Elk River.
My next question is related to this, and I'm not so sure there's an answer anywhere in America, but if you take a look at the take on small-town America, it's basically the young people are leaving. Left behind are those who may not even be capable of taking the jobs that this small town needs, and yet you hear every governor in the country, including Governor Brad Little, say what we have to do is bring jobs to these small towns. And I guess the question is it bringing jobs to the small towns, or is it bringing people back to small towns who would be able to do the work? And that leads me to the most controversial part of this issue. There are some who say that all those migrants down there on the border could rejuvenate small town America. I'm not so sure that's going to work in Idaho, but there may be some places in America where you could bring migrants, refugees. And as you're traveling around Idaho, I'm just wondering if you could get a sense of how many young people have left. And is that the take on small town Idaho, that it's left people behind who aren't going to want the jobs at the local restaurant or wherever there's a need for some of that basic employment that keeps a town buzzing?
Well, I do think that there is room in small town Idaho for in-migrants of all kinds. I think that having spent a year and a half of my life going around vineyards and wineries, let's be completely honest, without our Hispanic population, some who have their papers, some who don't, we really wouldn't have a wine industry. Mm-hmm. Those are the people who take care of the vineyards and who work in the industry. And I could see that replicated in ag and milk and all kinds of dairy, all kinds of industries throughout the state. Now, Governor Little, who comes from Emmett and was interviewed for this book, he's one of my people I focused on. He made a good point about if you want to keep people in small towns, and there are people who want to stay there. I did interview some young people who would love to stay there, but it's not easy. You have to bring sort of niche industries. He talked about everything from sort of making airplane parts to cutlery to these small kind of niche industries, the arts, for example. But it's not everybody who wants to live in a small town. It's sort of two-sided. There are people who kind of want to get away from big cities and are still connected, and that is a big difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are not technologically connected at all in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. That has changed in those four decades. I would say that the biggest problems that it seems to me that mitigate for small towns are isolation. Everybody knows your business. A woman in Oakley said to me, well, you know what I love about Oakley? It's a great place to raise your children. It's beautiful. It's the end of the road, but everybody – it's sort of Peyton Place. Everybody knows your business. And some of those towns like Oakley and some of the southeastern Idaho towns, it's no secret, are LDS towns. And so it's very much – if you're not part of the prevailing faith, you can feel very isolated. Mm-hmm. I do think the governor is right. I do think that I saw – there are actually a larger percentage of people in the arts in small towns. That was a sort of startling to me. I got some information from the Idaho Arts Commission, and there are a lot of artisans and people who have chosen to be there all throughout the small towns. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there's a simple answer because the problems are different. Right. Those towns who have – let's call it a resource, and that could be lava hot springs with hot water. And that could be Oakley with Oakley stone. That could be St. Mary's with timber. Those towns, of course, have a much better chance. And those towns which have a focus, the environment in Bonner's Ferry and the tribe up there, the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, have been very involved in – and this is a big change over 40 years. Now, they are very involved in environmental issues. So there's no one answer. And, you know, in Idaho, I think, as I said early in the book, kind of has three capitals. There's two time zones and three capitals, and we're unique. And the three capitals are, of course, Spokane, where people in northern Idaho go to shop and recreate. And in southeast Idaho, it's, of course, Salt Lake City. And Boise here, the densest part of the state. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Idaho City, Boise is the place that you go to shop and maybe to work. But let's talk for a second about a unique resource that Idaho has and other places in the West. We have ghost towns, living ghost towns, that are sort of laboratories. I really think we don't make enough use of them in our education. If you're studying Idaho history, you should drive that hour to Idaho City and see those brick buildings and get a feeling of how they came to be.
We'll talk about Murray in a minute. I think that's another one. You're listening to Alan Minskoff. He's the author of The Idaho Traveler. And if you want to travel the state of Idaho and get a take on its small towns, this is the book you need to buy, The Idaho Traveler by Alan Minskoff. Let's talk a little bit before we get to Murray about the town you said was the most changed of any you ran across, Rathdrum. Why is that?
Rathdrum has changed because of its location. It is close to Coeur d'Alene. It is close to Spokane. So it's become kind of a suburb. Now, when I was there, I think there were fewer than – I know there were fewer than 1,000 people. There's something that is the same, though. Rathdrum has more train business, more trains going through town than any place we went to, and you still hear them. And I asked myself, is that any changes? Well, we asked them to stop blowing their whistles, but they didn't. Or they didn't as much. But Rathdrum is unique in that the downtown is not so different. It's the surroundings that are packed with people. And yet Rathdrum, because of its size, does have more retail and has more activity. And they're doing some nice work with their old buildings there. There's, for those of you who love beer, there's a new brewery in Rathdrum with great food.
You are an expert on all matters, including beer. That's very impressive.
I'm not
Alan.
A beer drinker, though, but I did pay attention.
So as long as we're in Rathdrum, let's head east a little bit to the town of Wallace. And again, most of these towns you're talking about, I have not visited because they weren't on the tour of state board meetings I've had to attend over the last 15 years. But I did get to Wallace because we had Kathy, my wife, had a friend who actually lived in Wallace, and we wanted to track that out and see what that was all about. But you say about Wallace, if you ever get dispirited about small towns in Idaho, Wallace is the place you need to go for recovery.
Because, absolutely.
And tell us why that is. I mean, it is a great town. I mean, there's no doubt.
So Wallace is the most intact early 20th century town in Idaho. It has a terrific selection of old buildings. It has great boosters. People really care about that town. And it has really good food. The people who are coming into Wallace are doing things like setting up Seattle-style coffee places, wonderful restaurants. And it also has those things that make Idaho, Idaho. You can do a mining tour in Wallace. Wallace is, of course, the place that had brothels
longer
than any place in the state. In fact, I have a little Wallace story if we have time. It's
sure.
Short. So back in the early 70s. Actually, 1973, I can almost remember the date. I was doing an article on small towns in Idaho, and I went to interview the mayor who ran one of the automobile dealerships. And we're doing this interview, and he's very forthright. And in fact, he's funny, and he's talking about Wallace and why Wallace is different and unique. And he gets a phone call, and it's Governor Andrus. And the governor says, look, the feds are coming through to look at the highway, which was a big issue in Wallace because it was that those days it had the only stoplight on I-90. So the feds were coming through to talk about the rerouting of the highway, which eventually happened. And he said, the governor said, you've got to close the houses down. So I was sitting there at what seemed like a historic moment. Here's the irony of historic moments. I was talking to my – because I tell this story everywhere. I'm talking to my friends from Wallace, and they said, well, you know what? They did open them up again. But that was technically the end of the houses, but not literally the end of the houses.
That's a great story. So Hope – East Hope and Beyond Hope, and a famous resident of that town, Kermit Kiber.
And I interviewed his granddaughter, too, because, you know, I did want to talk to some young people.
Yeah.
Now, his granddaughter, Lindsay, is a journalist, and she's in her early 20s. She went through the University of Idaho in 3 years, a very bright girl. She coaches at one of the – so here's what I love about small towns, the generalist. The generalist is kind of gone in America. But in small town Idaho, the generalist is prospering. So she's a perfect example. She coaches volleyball. She's a writer in Sandpoint for the weekly paper there. She writes for them. She fishes. She hunts. Her grandfather proudly showed me her first elk. Mm-hmm. Anyways, she's a perfect example. And what she said is it's very hard to find housing. Now, she's connected. Her family's been there for generations. So she was able, through her connections, to find a little farmhouse to live in. But she was saying that she knows lots of young people who would love to live in Hope. First, it is drop-dead beautiful. It's on, you know, Lake Pendere, and it's on a beautiful part of the lake. It's not so busy as, say, like Sandpoint is. It's a tiny group of towns, but one is tinier than the other. And it's just, if you want to be in Hope, you do not need the hustle and bustle of the city. What you need is the beauty of the lake, the mountains, and the forest.
And Beyond Hope was just a little term that
It's kind of a term, but it's really just a place where people live.
Right, right.
Hope
right.
is the town. Beyond Hope is just sort of almost a jocular term for people live. East Hope actually exists too. But they have an interesting problem in Hope. One of the things that happens to you when you do this kind of thing is you get these little sidebar stories. Well, they're running out of space in their cemetery. And that's this is a tiny little place. And so that was an issue there that I never thought I would run into, but they're running out of space in their cemetery.
Wow, now there's a problem for an entrepreneur.
Yeah. The other thing about Hope that was remarkable is they are building monstrous mansions, some 8,000-10,000 square feet, because it's so beautiful there.
People moving in from all
over
the place.
People are moving in. In fact, there are some, you know, relatively well-known people who are going there.
Yeah, I think you mentioned in your book a couple of people from Hollywood who had landed up there somewhere in that vicinity in – oh, I think it was even farther north.
Even farther north.
Bonner's Ferry. Outside of Bonner's Ferry, you
can – some have stayed and some have gone.
Yeah.
There's been a couple of writers up there.
Yeah.
And there have been sculptors. It is a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, no question about that. And so I said we'd get back to Murray.
I love Murray,
and I don't want to miss a ghost town. So tell us about Murray.
Well, I've been to Murray three or four times. A couple of times because I'm on the Idaho Hedge Trust Board, and we have the wonderful duty of giving money to small towns and people who are renovating old buildings. And Murray is in pretty good shape too. Some of the ghost towns don't survive very well. They're remote, and the buildings have the weather. Murray still feels a lot like when I saw it in the 70s. So people very often ask me, well, which ones are similar, seem the same, or the most the same? Well, certainly Murray, Lava Hot Springs, Idaho City, the ghost towns have a lot of the feeling that they had back then. What was really funny about Murray this time is sometimes you have to do interviews on the fly. Mm-hmm. So I was hard to set up when there aren't that many people who live in Murray. In fact, one of the funny things I mentioned in the book is I asked three different people the population. One said, 40, one said 70, and one said 110. So somewhere in that
range,
you know the population of Murray.
So whether it's Idaho City or whether it's Murray or whether it's wherever else you want to call it a ghost town, do you ever offend any of the people who are actually living there? I mean, when I think of a ghost town, I think of a town where everybody's gone and they haven't been there in 100 years.
I think I try to call them living ghost towns.
Living ghost towns.
I think that's the term I hope to use. Because there are people who live there year-round.
Right.
And there's still some industry. There's still a little mill outside of Murray.
So I think we have time for one more question. And let's go to McCall, since it's a place that has become so popular with Boiseans and with people from out of state moving in. I was probably in McCall for any number of years before I ever knew there was something called Charlie's Gardens. Could you tell us about Charlie's Gardens?
Yeah. Charlie Davidson was a remarkable man. He did the landscape. In fact, let me back up. He came from New York. He was a writer, and he was a kind of a bon vivant. And he became a landscape architect, and he did remarkable work. Not the least of which was the landscape design for the Sun Valley Resort. He also created this remarkable garden in a place in McCall where a lot of people know there was a famous movie, North by Northwest. I think that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Where those folks stayed, where those folks were housed. They left, and his father, one of the Davidsons, bought that land. And then Charlie started to build this unique Northwest garden that is both rustic and imaginative. And his stepson, Chris Davidson, who's a longtime friend of mine, has stepped in now for many, many years and made that into a kind of a showplace. Now, it's not like exactly a public garden, but people up there go to it, and almost anybody you meet will go and visit the garden. And there's a tremendous variety of plant life. Some that you'd be amazed, many people would be amazed, can live there. And also the setting is pure Idaho. It is a northwest setting. There's a lovely water feature that runs through it. It is in the conifers, and yet it has this brilliant display of all kinds of flowers. And
it is really beautiful. And if you want to get there, you have to take Warren Wagon Road, and it's really between Warren Wagon Road and Payette Lake.
Exactly.
Right? Alan, this has been great. And we haven't by any means finished all of the towns you visited in this book that is 293 pages long. And you also have some great photos in here, by the way, that are just beautifully done. So I suggest once again to our listeners, grab a copy of The Idaho Traveler by Alan Minskoff. And Alan, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's
Corner. Thank
you, Bob. Next week, David Nywert, author of the book Of Orcas and Men, What Killer Whales Can Teach Us. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.